This is Please Explain. I'm Tori Maguire.
I have declared a state of disaster. Essentially, this declaration is the first time these powers have been used because we face unprecedented risk to life and property in coming days.
Given the worsening conditions we know that are ahead of us on Saturday, and given what our state's been through in the last few days, especially on New Year's Eve, we will be declaring a state of emergency from 9 a.m. tomorrow that will last 7 days.
It's hard to do justice to the scale of the devastation from this summer's national bushfire crisis. So far, 28 people have died. Around 6,000 buildings have been destroyed. More than 10 million hectares of land have burnt. And conservative estimates are that more than 1 billion animals have perished. And this week, the Bureau of Meteorology said that 2019 was the hottest and driest year ever recorded. Last week, Sydney Morning Herald environment editor Peter Hannam was in Maruya and Batemans Bay on the New South Wales south coast, where he witnessed firsthand the anxiety and challenges of one of the biggest evacuation efforts we've ever seen. This is episode 3 of our summer series on climate change and weather with Peter Hannam. Later on in the episode, The Age photographer Justin McManus will talk us through his 5 days at Mallacoota, where 4,000 people were trapped by fire and then rescued by the Navy. But first, Peter Hannam, thanks once again for being on Please Explain. This is number 3 in our series of climate change episodes of Please Explain over the summer. Last time you and I talked was the week before Christmas, and we talked about water, and we had some idea. New South Wales was already experiencing poor air quality because of the big fires northwest of Sydney. There had already been losses of property. We're now in the second week of January, after many people went on a break. But what has happened since that time has been extraordinary. It's now front page news all around the world. You departed the office on New Year's Day to head south to the south coast of New South Wales, and you were down there for 5 days. Tell me what that was like. What did you find when you got down there?
So to come to a place like Batemans Bay, when there's no electricity, very poor communications. So anyone, for example, with an Optus phone had no communications at all, and the Telstra one had been damaged partly by the fires, so people were struggling to get any kind of contact. No food, fuel pumps are electric driven, so petrol and diesel were unavailable. When you turn up to a place like Batemans Bay, which is a major holiday center, you're finding really people who are quite anxious about the fires in the area and wanting to get out, and even more anxious that they can't.
Yeah, look, everyone's trying to get out. We know that Saturday is going to be a bad day. The advice is to get out. But Coles opened yesterday and they had some bare essentials, but we'd stocked up. We had water. So where we are, there is no internet, there's no power, there's no phones.
And so we met people who were saying that their children were screaming and yelling and fearful that they were going to die, that people were scrambling for water. There was a single fish and chips restaurant open in one of the towns near Batemans Bay, and only because a carnival nearby had lent them a generator. So was it this kind of scramble? Nobody could get cash, for example. So anything that people were relying on, typically like EFTPOS, other kind of payments through their phones, just unusable. And so we had people telling us, you know, it's like going back to the 1940s.
This fire is Australia's war at the moment. It's been right down the Great Dividing Range, and now it's going right to the coast. And there isn't one ADF on the ground. That's what we want. We pay $6 billion of hard-earned taxpayers' money for them every year. Where are they?
And what was the tone? Were people angry or anxious or panicked?
There was anxiety, certainly. Some anger. I mean, these are people, mind you, for outsiders who'd gone, this was their probably, you know, key holiday of the year, really being ruined around them, and having all the concern about how do you get back out, and even to tell your relatives that you're safe. The concern was you're spending days in heavy smoke. You're waking up in what normally would be an idyllic kind of holiday environment, thinking about where you're going to get fuel when it finally turns on, how you're going to get out.
And did you get a sense that there was any coordination or government support for this mass evacuation, the biggest evacuation we've ever had in Australian history?
Well, I think the main evidence of kind of government activity on the ground was the creation of evacuation centres. And so there was an effort then to register people who had lost their homes and had been sent there, or others who needed a place to stay out of fear of maybe the, you know, their holiday place was near to an existing fire front. And so we found people, for instance, who were given 4 days payment so they could stay in one of the quickly emptying resorts in Batemans Bay. So there was a little bit of that kind of assistance. However, in terms of the availability of, say, generators, when we were driving out on the 5th, so this is, you know, really 5 or 6 days after the fires had come through, we saw convoys of protected generators being shipped into the south coast towns. So that was quite a while afterwards.
Our colleague at the Australian Financial Review, Phil Khoury, wrote a piece in Monday's Fin Review about his experience of trying to get from his coast house down the south coast back to his family home in Canberra and not having enough petrol and not being able to find it. And it's a very calm piece, but it really gets the sense that he spent days wondering, where's the military? There's no, like, hundreds of thousands of people have been ordered to evacuate and there's no one coordinating this. There has been a lot of anger about the fact that the military weren't brought in sooner. Would it have made a big difference, do you think?
It was and continues to be a puzzle for many people, given that Jervis Bay is up the coast one way, there's other military bases in the, you know, coastal regions. Why weren't they perhaps, you know, given some kind of alert that you're going to be needed? And in some cases, it doesn't even need to be military. It could just be police ensuring that the traffic continues to flow. You identify certain points, maybe bottlenecks, you know, because the lights are often out in these places and probably only need one bingle of some kind of accident and then things get even more stalled. So just some kind of anticipation. Like, for example, the petrol stations, I understand, in Batemans Bay, one of them lost more than $10,000 in a single day with people taking fuel and driving off. Didn't have cash. So what are you going to do? Others were saying, well, they should have given out vouchers, $50 or something else, and just anticipate that this is kind of the environment. So you almost put out of business. A lot of companies already struggling in this area. So this sort of, why hadn't we foreseen these kind of problems? Is it because we haven't had evacuations of this scale, you know, maybe in those parts, but perhaps we've had them elsewhere in North Queensland when there are massive floods around Townsville or somewhere else. So if there are any lessons being learnt, there hasn't been that kind of, say, national coordination where those lessons were kind of learned and anticipated. There's probably going to be more this summer. I hope we learn more for next time.
You're listening to Please Explain. We'll be right back after this.
From the team that brought you Phoebe's Fall and Wrong Skin comes a new 10-part investigative podcast.
Motor vessel Pong Su, I intend to board you.
I thought to myself, this is this f***ing boat.
The Last Voyage of the Pong Su is a story of drugs, cops, espionage, military, death, a dictator and mateship.
Flag of my honour is Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
150 kilos of heroin had never been imported before.
These people, they expected to be executed.
It's a dead person.
Holy shit.
Search for The Last Voyage of the Pong Su on your favourite podcast app.
I want to talk to you about the trauma of what people who actually got caught up in the flames themselves have been through. A couple of days after the fires went through Cobargo, the Prime Minister went and visited that town, and some of the locals were very upset at his presence and were quite vocal.
I'm only shaking your hand if you give more funding to our RFS. So many people here have lost their homes.
Oh, I'm going to Kirribilli. We might burn that down.
This is not fair. We are totally forgotten about down here. Every single time this area has a flood or a fire, we get nothing.
One of the people who had yelled at the Prime Minister did a Facebook video where he went back to the house where he had been when the fire came through, and he just described what he and the other people that were there who had been trying to defend that house went through.
Just want to tell you a bit of a story so everyone knows what happened. When the fire came through, it hit us that hard and that fast we didn't know what to do. We're in the house, burning around us. Everything just started catching on flames and blowing up everything in sight. I was running from the window to window where Troy's trying to put the back door out here. Once we ran out of water, I had to start running on cans of drink, any soft drink out of the fridge, milk. We bloody used soap. We used any liquid we could use. The flames were just going crazy.
It's very harrowing watching he was clearly very traumatised and sort of said, you know, I yelled at the Prime Minister, I was in shock. And you could tell in this video that this man is very, very distressed. Did you meet people who had been actually caught up in the flames?
My experience was, you know, in some ways, frankly, surprising, because everybody we spoke to when we were talking to them, often we were visiting their homes with them that they are actually seeing as we see them, or they're picking over the molten aluminium and glass of what used to be their, you know, house.
Yeah, and so among the people we met was this RFS volunteer who was working from the station in Badala, that's inland from Naruma. This person, he'd lost his house, and eight other rural fire service volunteers lost their houses too in this fire. And when we spoke to him, it was clear that there was, you know, the trauma, if you like, hadn't set in yet, because he was out there working to fight on the next bunch of fires.
Running on adrenaline.
Totally. So when that runs out, and when he has to look at, you know, picking over his house and loses the camaraderie of the people he'd been working with for the last few days, that's when actually some of the problems will really start to hit the surface, you'd think. Now, in his case, he'd lost his wife from cancer the year before, had managed to save her possessions, the photographs, those key mementos. Otherwise, he would have lost other, you know, everything else, and including his dog, and he was going to go back and look for it. But there'll be many of these sort of examples of once the emergency levels passed and the people come back to their towns and they see and think, how are we going to get through this? How is this community going to rebuild? Many people won't come back. They'll, if they had insurance, they might consider rebuilding, but many of them probably were underinsured. So their financial straits will also be a problem.
Tell me about the mayor of Yorubadala, Liz Innes, and her thoughts on it.
Yes, so she had her own experience, spent more than a day trying to get out of her property after it was saved. No communications. People were wondering, why isn't Liz speaking about her experiences? Well, she was trying to get out. It took 6 hours just to cut the trees to get out of her particular place. So she was also coming to terms with the disruption, but at least she'd kept her house together.
Hi, everyone. Look, I just thought I'd do a bit of a post. I'm out here at Runnyford. The fires absolutely just swept through us like a dose of salt. That's putting it politely, like a wildfire. Anyway, we've lost our big shed, but so far we've managed to save the houses. And yeah, it's a pretty tough kind of a experience to have gone through, but we're all okay and we're alive. Just pleading with everybody, I hope you've listened to all the warnings and you've got your fire plans ready to go.
But she told us that actually, since fires had broken out in the Yorubadala region from about November 26th onwards, that community had already seen inflows of tourism dropping. The Princess Highway had been cut on multiple times. So they'd already started to gear up for, you know, the economic disruption to come. This was obviously much worse than she could have anticipated. She taught us that eventually when people start to weigh up what's next, it's going to need, and as she put it, a lot of people showering a lot of love on the south coast of New South Wales.
And not just showering love, we need to shower money.
So far, there's a $2 billion recovery fund from the federal government. But when they start to assess, as the Victorian government apparently has put forward a list in the hundreds of millions, now Victorian fires have got probably weeks, if not longer, to burn, so that list is obviously going to get longer. New South Wales is probably closer to the end of its bushfire season, we hope, but even that, if it's got weeks to go, there'll be more damage. We haven't even taken into account what might happen if the contamination of the catchments for Sydney and all of these coastal towns, many of them have lost the forest around their catchment. If there's decontamination issues for the water supplies, which is a real chance for a whole range of these places, especially for Sydney, then that bill could be astronomical. So $2 billion is probably really the starting point.
You're listening to Please Explain. We'll be right back after this.
Hi, I'm Michael Batchelard. I'm the Investigations and Foreign Editor at The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald have by far the country's biggest investigations teams, breaking stories about corruption, crime, and social and political issues. We also have foreign correspondents in Asia, China, Europe and the US. Both are expensive but crucial to providing news for and by Australians that help our readers interpret the world. And if people value that, we need people to subscribe so we can keep doing it. Subscribers allow us to dig deeper into the important stories that matter to our readers.
Joining us now is The Age photographer Justin McManus. Welcome, Justin. You arrived by boat in Mallacoota about 2.5 days after fire swept through and left 4,000 people stranded on the beach there. Can you tell me what it was like when you arrived?
We arrived on the Thursday, so everyone there lost track of what day it was. So the Thursday would have been the 2nd, I think. And the trip along in the boat, sort of a fairly forlorn experience in that, you know, just about the whole way from Lake's entrance, you know, where the coast was shrouded in smoke and the smoke was being blown straight out across Bass Strait and the water was really still and it was really quite eerie. And as we got closer to Mallacoota, you could see these enormous fires just still burning away. And then I was greeted by a local photographer, Rachel Mousey. So she took us into town. We met a few people, one being a fella called Russell, who'd lost his house. We went off and we did a quick story on him on the first night that we arrived. And then we went back to the pub and were speaking to people and just getting to get a bit of a sense of what that experienced and how they were feeling at this point.
I'm Mary. We've been staying at Mallacoota for a few weeks. We witnessed Mallacoota almost burn to the ground. At times it was ferocious. It was like hearing Armageddon, freight trains racing across paddocks. At other times it was eerily quiet. It went completely dark at about 10 o'clock in the morning and all the birds stopped. We all felt we were prepared for bushfires, but I don't think any of us felt prepared for the severity of what we witnessed. And we just feel so lucky that we survived, the town largely survived, the properties we're staying at survived, and we just hope Mallacoota can bounce back to be the beautiful remote wilderness holiday destination that we've come to love for many years.
What was the mood like?
On Thursday night, the mood was quite good. Homes had been lost. There was devastation. There was the decimation of the forests and the bushland and many houses were lost in Mallacoota. But miraculously, no one had died. So that made an enormous difference to the feeling of the town. You know, I photographed the aftermath of Black Saturday and I went into communities where there was an enormous amount of death and, you know, that was very somber. There was a lot of grief. This was a bit different. No one had been lost. There was trauma. It was stressful. But, yeah, people were a lot more upbeat. And in many ways, some people were, you know, given the amount of holidays there were many people still determined to, you know, enjoy their holiday. And in the pub on the Thursday night, you know, they had the jukebox going and there was a lot of youngsters in there playing pool and having a good time. So, I mean, beyond there, which we didn't sort of get to see until the following day, was down at the relief centre, and that was the day the evacuation was to begin with the HMAS Chules. So walking around there and talking to people, you know, there was a lot of very anxious people that were still feeling the trauma. And given the forecast for another very severe fire day on Saturday, They were pretty desperate to get out.
You met some families, didn't you, who'd been prioritised for airlift, and because of the terrible conditions, the airlifts just got delayed and delayed. Were they getting particularly stressed about that, people there with young kids?
Yeah, those were the families that I met on Saturday morning, and that's when they weren't very keen or the, you know, the evacuees were told by the Navy that they didn't want young children. They only wanted children of school age and above, so above 5, to be making that journey on the landing craft and to be ferried out to the HMAS Chules, because it was, the seas were picking up a little bit and it would have been a bit difficult for parents to be carrying their children onto those barges. So I only become aware of that on the Saturday morning. So yeah, that's when I started to meet a lot of families that had young children that thought they would have been prioritised to be evacuated, and that didn't happen. So that's where there was a fair bit of distress sort of creeping in amongst those families. And, you know, that many of them had had a few false runs to the airport to be airlifted out, and they'd spent, you know, hours and hours at the airport in the hope that the smoke would lift or the wind would blow it away and the visibility would improve to the point where they could get aircraft in to evacuate them. But that didn't happen. So they were getting pretty frustrated. This was sort of on the Saturday. Yeah, they were still there, and this was when the second day of severe fire weather was coming through. So there was a fair bit of anxiety amongst those people. You know, the kids were starting to suffer, especially kids that, you know, had asthma or respiratory problems. And that, you know, applied to the elderly as well. And that was getting, obviously getting fairly testy for everyone. The weather was warming up and it was hot in there, and there was no power still. Well, there's still no power as far as I know. The only power was at the pub and the supermarkets that were still operating, and a cafe and a restaurant. And then, you know, the same thing happened on Saturday that happened on the night of the fires on Monday, when day turned to night and this blood red sky appeared again. And that must have brought back a lot of terrifying memories for a lot of people that were still there.
It was certainly an extraordinary set of circumstances for all those people to find themselves in. And then an extraordinary thing for the rest of us to watch, you know, knowing that people were trapped there and that the Navy was on its way. Just finally, what was your sort of overall impression? You were there until Monday morning when you got on another boat to get out. What was your overall impression of that weekend and what you experienced?
The whole thing was quite surreal in a way. This was this massive peacetime evacuation taking place in Australia, and these people have been stranded in and isolated without, you know, food, water. You know, that's not the sort of thing you expect to happen in this country. But then in a way, it wasn't surprising. You know, we've been warned for years that, you know, bushfire conditions are going to deteriorate. We're going to have longer seasons. We're going to have more intense fires. This is the new normal. This is summertime in Australia where, you know, it's not going to be people holidaying down the beach and in a carefree, easygoing manner. People are going to be on edge because they're going to be worried if they're going to be put in the front of bushfires.
Well, Justin, not many people would willingly sail towards a situation like that and put themselves into that set of circumstances. Your photos were amazing. Thanks so much for that. And thanks for being on Please Explain.
Thanks, Terry.
Thanks so much to our Please Explain guests this week, Environment Editor Peter Hannam from the Sydney Morning Herald and Justin McManus, a photographer from The Age. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Subscriptions power our newsrooms, so to support independent journalism, search Subscribe, The Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. If you've been enjoying this podcast, please leave us a rating or review on iTunes. This episode of Please Explain was produced and edited by Leah Samoglu. Additional production support from Anu Hasbold and audio assistance from Rachel Ferrullo. Amelia Maguire manages logistics and planning, and Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori Maguire. Thanks for listening.